Disc 5.
Rocky's dad's place was a typical low-income Tohunga house. It was locked up and nobody was home. The guns were hidden inside, Rocky said, but we had no way to get in. So much for our playbook. The whole deal was abruptly put on hold. We headed for the place to have a beer. I knew that Chacon would be setting up surveillance for our meeting with Bob and Sergio at Coco's. There was no way for me to get word to him or Bob. I was trying to play it cool, telling myself that the gun deal would still go down as planned. But I knew Rocky's patterns too well. I knew that he operated on impulsive opportunity. If he met some girl at the place that he wanted to have sex with, the buy would be off. But Rocky must have really needed the gun money. "Let's go," he barked after we'd finished one beer apiece. "My old man is supposed to be there." On the drive, Rocky asked me if I thought my friend Bob would be interested in buying some dope. "Sure, Rock, if the price is right. He'll be into it big time." Rocky asked to see my cell phone and then dialed up his meth connection. "Yo, Richie, I'm looking to buy a few OZs. You good for it?" Chacon had recently gotten me a rat phone, an ordinary cellular phone fitted with a sensitive audio bug that could be used for remotely activated surveillance. When I punched a few buttons in the correct order, Chacon could dial in and listen to conversations from his backup vehicle. The rat phone isn't a recorder, but rather a transmitter that works off cell towers. It's designed to provide an undercover agent with some peace of mind, knowing that his backup can hear his real-time conversations, and therefore make a move if things sound like they're going south. But as with any cellular phone, it didn't always work well inside buildings or in bad weather, and whole conversations might be lost to static and dead air. Eventually, I simply stopped carrying it. The risk of one of the guys borrowing it at a drunken Mongo free-for-all and later taking it to a tech expert to be examined outweighed any safety value it provided as a surveillance device. When we got to Rocky's dad's house, he was sitting out back, rolling a joint. Rocky took a long drag but didn't pass it my way. By this time he knew that I wasn't much into the drug scene. I had transported and sold drugs for Rocky. And after that drug test during the Laughlin run, Rocky was convinced that I'd do a line or smoke a joint if and when I really wanted to. That was good enough for him. I followed Rocky to the back bedroom, where he bent down and started pulling guns out from under the bed. First the shotgun, followed by a couple of rifles, then an AK-47, but no machine gun. I was disappointed. Rocky handed me the shotgun and a couple of other rifles, then slid the rest of the guns back under the bed. We carried the guns outside and put them in the trunk of my car. Rocky's connection, Richie, called on my cell phone and told Rocky we were good to go on 4 ounces of crank. Richie said that we should meet with him this evening around 10 at the Wed, a bar in Pacoima. We were late for the meet, but I'd reached Bob on his cell to tell him about the delay. No big deal. Bob operated on drug dealer time anyway. I told Rocky that I had to run home and pick up the money for the shotgun. I dropped him off at the place. Broke as ever, he borrowed a few bucks from me for beer. I hit Chacon on his cell phone and told him to meet me just off Lowell Avenue. In a few minutes, I was sitting in Chacon's Pontiac, laying out the details of the gun and methamphetamine deal. It was turning into a pretty unusual operation, and we didn't want any unforeseen complications. I was carrying 2 recording devices just to be sure we got the whole thing on tape. I would be slipping Bob the cash to pay Rocky for the guns, but now I'd have to slip him a few thousand more for the drugs. I sped back to the place to pick up Rocky, then on to Coco's. As I pulled into the restaurant parking lot, I spotted Bob and Sergio in their car. In the darkness, it wouldn't be a problem to pull guns out of my trunk and transfer them to Bob's. I reached into the glove compartment and released the trunk. Bob said he was satisfied with the guns as long as they were all in good working order. Rocky guaranteed that they were, all on tape. Sergio had a decoy conversation going with Rocky about the AK-47, and while Rocky was distracted, I slipped the ATF money into Bob's hand. Mission accomplished. Now it was time to finish up the meth deal. We drove to a ratty hole in the wall in Pacoima with an unlit gravel parking lot, perfect for an outdoor drug deal. As I pulled in, I caught a glimpse of Chacon's black Pontiac parked in the rear of a business across the street. Rocky quickly found his connection at the bar. Richie was in his late 30s, not a biker, but rough-looking, heavy-set and muscular, with a ponytail that reached three-quarters of the way down his back. He wasn't new to this game, and he eyed me with suspicion. Rocky assured Richie that he didn't have to worry about any of us. I was a full-patch Mongol, and Bob and Sergio were friends of mine. Richie nodded. He and Rocky then made a quick run to his house to get the crank. Alone at the bar with Bob and Sergio, I took out a few thousand ATF dollars and passed them to Bob. "Listen," I said. "When the deal's done, meet me at the intersection near Lowell and the 210. If you get there before me, just wait. I'll drop Rocky off and meet you. We'll voucher the shit then." When Rocky and Richie returned, we all went out to Richie's pickup truck. Richie handed the 4 ounces of meth to Bob. Bob handed the thick wad of cash to Richie. My adrenaline was pumping throughout the transaction. I'd been involved in hundreds of similar drug and gun deals, and no matter how carefully they're planned, there's always the possibility of a last-minute fuck-up. Paranoia runs high among dealers, and a lot of good cops have been shot by some punk who freaks out at the last minute. But this deal went down without a hitch. Everybody left the parking lot pleased. As I drove Rocky back to his place on Foothill Boulevard, I nodded to myself. 3 guns and 4 ounces of meth in one smooth deal. ATF and the U.S. Attorney's Office would be beside themselves. I dropped Rocky off and headed for the meet with Bob and Sergio. Turning off Foothill onto Tohunga Canyon Boulevard, I saw a couple of Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies sitting in their car at the corner watching traffic. From a cop's point of view, it was a no-brainer. Ratty-ass Mustang plus dirtbag operator equals one automatic field interrogation. The deputies lit me up before I had made it a quarter mile down to Tohunga Canyon. I didn't have an updated registration sticker for my UC car and could only hope they hadn't caught it. I slid my gun under the seat as their red lights began to glare in my rearview mirror. Clearly, I was in for a hassle, even though I wasn't speeding, and I hadn't run any stoplights or signs. I eased over to the side of the road and shut the engine down. I knew the routine and kept my hands on the steering wheel as one of the deputies approached from each side of the car. I had rolled the window down to speak with the deputy when he approached. "Good evening," he said. "May I see your driver's license and registration?" "Sure," I said, leaning over to open the glove box. I was assisted by the flashlight from the deputy standing on the other side of the car. His hand was gripping his gun. I removed the registration and handed it over with my driver's license. He looked at the license for a couple of seconds without speaking. Then he said, "Would you mind stepping out of the car, Mr. St. John?" I did as the officer asked. "Step back to the rear of the car for me." Again, I complied immediately. Then came the usual questions. "How much you had to drink tonight? Where you headed? Where you coming from? Got anything in the car you shouldn't have?" Then one officer asked a question that turned the next couple of hours upside down. "Do you mind if we search your car?" "No, you can't search my car." I asked him why he stopped me in the first place. He said that my registration had expired. Shit! He asked why I had a problem with him looking in the car. I told him that I just didn't want him looking through my personal things. I told him that he had no right to look in the car, and that if he searched it without my permission, anything he found wouldn't be admissible in court anyway. The deputy glared at me and told me to have a seat on the curb. He said it wasn't going to be an illegal search. He was going to legally tow my car in and then do an inventory of it. I sat down on the curb and started cursing to myself, thinking about Bob and Sergio out there somewhere with 4 ounces of government-purchased meth and 3 guns that needed to be vouchered now, or the whole goddamn deal was going to be inadmissible in court. It was crucial that we preserve the chain of custody for that evidence. Frustrated, I decided to take a chance. I pulled my rat phone out of my pocket and dialed up Chacon. He answered the phone, and I had just enough time to blurt out a quick, "John, I'm on Tohunga Canyon Road, and I need you down here ASAP," before one of the deputies pulled the phone from my hand and turned it off. I watched the other deputy going through my car. When he got to the driver's side, I saw him bend down as if he was looking under the seat. He'd have had to be blind not to see the handgun. "Cuff him." The deputy's orders were clear. "Put your hands behind your back." He put the handcuffs on and locked them in place. Then he asked me about the phone call. "Who the hell were you calling? Who the hell is John?" "Just a friend of mine. If somebody drives by here and cranks off a round at me, you know I'm going to shoot you first and then shoot your friend John." "That might look kind of bad, you shooting a prisoner in handcuffs." He told me not to worry, he would take the cuffs off me first. I was hoping that no cars or trucks let off a loud backfire near the area to spook these guys. The deputies had called for backup, which was now arriving on the scene with lights flashing. They were driving a black and white 4x4, and I was promptly tucked away in the back with my hands cuffed behind me. I saw the hook arrive, and they started towing away the Mustang, complete with its expensive ATF surveillance system, which a routine inventory would surely expose. It looked like I was going to be spending the night in jail. I knew that Bob and Sergio had to be getting anxious, waiting for me. If the cops jammed them, they'd have our evidence and we'd all be spending the night in jail. Where the hell was Chacon? Just before I was driven off to jail, Chacon pulled up driving his personal BMW. He stopped in the road right beside us. He badged one of the deputies. Two other deputies joined in the conversation. The deputies asked for Chacon's credentials again as he explained to them that I was a confidential informant for ATF and that I was on a very sensitive assignment. The deputies remained skeptical. As an ex-cop myself, I could see how they might think we were a couple of bad guys trying to run a scam. Chacon did have what appeared to be legitimate ATF credentials, not a form of identification that patrolmen see often. But he wasn't driving a federal government car, and I had been so uncooperative, was so unwashed and unkempt and in possession of a handgun, that they had to assume I was probably a wanted criminal, and the only prudent course of action was to make the collar and run my fingerprints through the system. Chacon said that if they didn't believe his ATF credentials were legit, then they should call Paul, an L.A. County Sheriff's deputy who would vouch for us. Paul was one of the few law enforcement people outside ATF who knew about my undercover role. He and his partner, Cletus, were deputies who, though not undercover, worked the OMG scene as plainclothesmen, dressed in jeans and motorcycle jackets, riding Harleys. We sometimes crossed paths at various biker bars and parties. Chacon had let Cletus and Paul know about my undercover role several months before. In the beginning, I was dead set against it. I didn't trust them, just as I didn't trust anyone outside our tight-knit ATF corps. But Cletus and Paul both proved to be true blue law enforcement brothers and an invaluable intelligence asset to the investigation. The deputies reached Paul on the phone and asked if he knew about a guy named Billy St. John who was working with ATF. Paul told them that he knew me. They asked him what kind of car Billy St. John drove, and Paul replied that Billy drove a rusted-out red Mustang with a black top. I could see that the deputies still had no idea what to think of the dirtbag biker they had in the back seat of their black and white. It didn't look like anyone was reaching for the handcuff key. They kept grilling Chacon about the firearm they'd found in my Mustang. "Okay, did you know your informant was carrying a gun?" It had turned into one of those interagency standoffs that are all too common in the murky world of undercover work. Partly, it's just the nature of the law enforcement beast. No cop wants to be responsible for a fuck-up he'll have to answer for down the line. Our real quandary stemmed from one of the dirty little secrets of undercover life, a fact that no training program can prepare you for. When you're deep undercover, you simply cannot trust your fellow law enforcement officers. You never know who might blow your cover, and in order to survive on the street, you must live by the rule that divulging your true identity to a cop, any cop, can get you killed. Outlaw biker gangs, like the mafia, have often bribed cops and developed long-term informants inside various local and federal law enforcement agencies. In fact, in the course of our investigation, we discovered that the Mongols had turned a California Highway Patrol dispatcher into an informant. He was working for Domingo and the guys in my own San Fernando Valley chapter, hanging out at the place and feeding the Mongols anything they wanted from the Highway Patrol's computer system. Information on vehicle registrations, outstanding warrants, and confidential addresses. After an investigation, the California Highway Patrol dispatcher, Bruce Paul Boyson, pled guilty to a felony count of unauthorized computer access. On August 10, 2000, he was sentenced to 180 days in jail and placed on 3 years probation. These sheriff's deputies weren't about to uncuff me and turn me loose with an unlicensed handgun until they checked with a superior officer. More sheriff's department cars pulled up, and out of one stepped a sergeant. The deputies pulled me from their black and white and took the cuffs off. They wouldn't give me back my gun, so they handed it to Chacon. At least he'd shown law enforcement credentials. As they drove away, I reminded Chacon that Bob and Sergio were waiting for me with 4 ounces of meth and 3 guns that needed to be vouchered immediately. I put in a call to Bob and told him to meet us on a side street just off Tujunga Canyon Boulevard. A couple of minutes later, we were parked next to each other, and Chacon had vouchered the 4 ounces of meth and the 3 illegal guns. What could have turned into a long night in jail was now looking like one of the better undercover scores in the case. I was still in my first few weeks as a full patch when Domingo approached me with an unexpected proposition. "Billy, you're going to be the secretary treasurer of the chapter." Rocky had been acting as the chapter's secretary treasurer, handling the books and dues when I first started hanging around the club. He wasn't a good choice as anyone's bookkeeper. Not only was he functionally illiterate, but he'd regularly allowed money to be taken from the till. Rocky had to answer to the National Secretary Treasurer, Leno Luna, patched in with the mother chapter down in Commerce. Mother was getting upset with the SFV chapter's late dues and other missed financial obligations. Domingo was taking constant flack from Mother because of Rocky's irresponsibility, and he wanted someone as Secretary Treasurer who could actually handle the job. I was the most logical candidate. I had a steady job, or so the gang thought. In the avionics industry. They knew I had a military background, which meant I was more disciplined than a typical gangster running on meth. Normally, you had to be in the gang for at least 1 year before you could become an officer. Domingo said that he would get an exception made from the national officers and Mother. I had been a full patch for just over a month when the word came from Mother that the secretary treasurer position was mine. It was unbelievable. Not only was I a full patch, but now I was a club officer, which brought a level of prestige and privilege not afforded rank-and-file members. They trusted me with the chapter books, which, of course, would later turn out to be a crucial piece of evidence establishing that the club was an ongoing criminal enterprise. As secretary-treasurer, I now had access to all the national officers and got a chance to look at Mother's records. I was responsible for taking notes at church and any other official meetings. I handled all the club's money issues, and when the chapter came into property, usually by extortion or robbery, the secretary treasurer was responsible for its disposition. I met with Leno Luna down in Commerce once a week. Luna was a dark-skinned Mexican in his mid-40s who stood about 5'10" and weighed somewhere around 220. An original Mongol who was around during the first war with the Hells Angels. He was a fairly laid-back guy, and I enjoyed being around him. But I could never lose sight of the fact that he was a hardcore Mongol who rode with Red Dog and Diablo, two of the most violent members in the gang. It didn't take me long to get the SFV chapter back on good terms with Mother. I made Domingo happy. I made the bosses in ATF happy with the unprecedented access I was getting to the club's inner workings and its most important financial documents, even the gang's official constitution. But the greatest evidentiary value of the club's books was that it put the gang's hierarchical structure on paper from the rank-and-file patches to the national president. It wasn't just my word anymore. The book showed the Mongols Motorcycle Club was, as John Chacon later wrote in his 167-page affidavit in support of our search warrants, a highly organized criminal enterprise with a defined multi-level chain of command. The books showed that the club had between 150 and 200 members in Southern California, and some 21 chapters across the country, each with a president, vice president, sergeant-at-arms, and secretary-treasurer, and that the chapters answered and paid a percentage of all income to the mother chapter, which was built on the same structure and represented the Mongol nation as a whole. This was the hard evidence we needed to prove that the club was a form of organized crime for a prosecution under the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. I made a clear record of the collection of dues from the various chapters, money acquired through gun trafficking, drug dealing, and extortion. I made a record of all money paid out for legal funds and to bail bondsmen. I compiled a list of post office boxes and storage facilities that members of the gang had rented, which would be essential when it came time for us to start preparing search warrants. Through the national books, I also learned about the war plans for the state of Colorado. There had recently been a showdown between the Mongols and the Sons of Silence Motorcycle Club in Denver. I saw that the Colorado chapter hadn't been paying its dues recently, and I asked Luna why. He told me that the Colorado chapter was allowed to keep its dues money in order to purchase firearms for the upcoming war. I also learned that the Mongols were looking to send reinforcements to Colorado to back the Mongols' play against the Sons of Silence. The Mongols were always looking for ways to make money without anybody going to jail. During church, I suggested numerous times that the club incorporate, copyright the Mongols' name, and trademark the colors. Everyone knew that the Hells Angels were making a fortune legitimately, marketing their famous winged death's head, and suing anyone who used the name and logo without permission. Leno Luna and Little Dave, the national president, shot me down whenever I suggested it. Their argument was that if the club did incorporate, we would be inviting government scrutiny. "We'll have the fucking FBI and ATF on our asses," they always said. They wanted nothing to do with anything legitimate. I suggested that we make some above-board money selling T-shirts. We could print up a few thousand Mongol shirts, then go to every T-shirt outlet in the L.A. area and leave them there on a consignment basis. Tell the shop owners that we'd be back in a week to pick up the money for the shirts. Again, this was too goody-goody for the Mongols. They always needed some other angle, usually one employing their well-developed extortion skill. They suggested that we simply walk in the shops and, just short of armed robbery, demand money for the T-shirts. If the store owner paid up, we'd leave with the money and the shirts. My marketing plans never went anywhere after that. Any kind of legitimate business, as far as the gang was concerned, was too much work. It was a lot less complicated to live as a gangster. During church one day, Domingo announced that Eva would be transferring from the West Side chapter to the SFV chapter. As a secretary-treasurer, I realized that this was good news for the SFV coffers. As an ATF special agent, I realized it was even better news for our investigation. Eva wielded a lot of influence in the club, and he was a good earner. Unlike guys like Rocky and Rancid, who basically scratched together income from meth deals and extortion jobs, Evil was a professional motorcycle thief. He was one of the Mongols' key players in a massive multi-million-dollar stolen vehicle ring that had spread from California throughout the Southwest. I'd first met Evil back when I was prospecting. He was in his late 20s with long black hair that he wore in a braided ponytail, a clean-shaven boyish face, and an array of tattoos on both arms. But he'd been in the club long enough that his colors were attached to a denim vest. Only a few Mongols were permitted to sport denim instead of black leather, a kind of grandfather clause among the outlaws. Evil worked as a mechanic and rode the fastest street-legal Harley-Davidson I've ever seen. We were hauling ass one night on the 210 north of L.A. I was running better than 130 miles per hour, when to my astonishment, Evil flew past me doing a good 20 miles per hour better. And he had Karina hanging on the back. He later told me that he still had throttle left when he passed me, but had started having visions of teeth, hair, and eyeballs spread all over the concrete. The first time I saw Evil's bike-thieving skills in action, we were in Pasadena on a sunny afternoon, and the sidewalks were packed with eyewitnesses. There were some 60 Mongols partying that afternoon at a trendy restaurant and bar called Moose McGillicuddy's. There were also four preppy, good-time Harley riders in the restaurant, and they left their machines in the parking lot, at the mercy of the Mongol nation. I watched as Evil and a few other Mongols walked straight to the chromed-out Harleys in the lot. In a matter of seconds, wires were ripped out from under tanks, engines were roaring, and the four bikes were speeding out of Pasadena, closely followed by a carload of Mongols carrying guns. John Chacon, parked 100 yards away on surveillance duty, managed to capture the whole bike theft operation with his telephoto lens. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had very little experience doing stolen motorcycle investigations, and Chacon initially wanted me to stick to guns, drugs, and violence. But Assistant United States Attorneys Sally Mellock and Jerry Friedberg expressed a strong interest in prosecuting the Mongols in the stolen bike trade. Through the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, LASO, we quickly enlisted the help of Rick Angel from the Progressive Insurance Agency. Progressive Insurance had its own investigative arm, made up largely of retired police detectives, and they said they'd provide us with their intelligence on stolen bikes. More crucially, given the administrative hurdles that Chacon and I were often running into in the corridors of ATF, Progressive agreed to provide us with the front money with which to purchase stolen motorcycles. I jumped into the deep end of the business. I started buying stolen Harleys from Evil and his connections. All the while, I was learning how to tear Harleys down, learning which parts had to be destroyed and replaced so the cops would never know that a machine was stolen. Evil called me to say his connection had a brand new Softail Springer ready to be delivered whenever I wanted. Our plan with Progressive Insurance was to buy a bike and put it through the complete strip-down and changeover. The intelligence gained from the conversion of my stolen Springer would be a template with which to prosecute all the people involved in the stolen bike business. I wanted the bike delivered to my UC place in Diamond Bar. Chacon and the other backup guys were scurrying around to get people in place who could ID and photograph the bad guys. The deal was set. The guys were supposed to deliver the bike to me at 4 o'clock that afternoon. I planned to be at my pad waiting with Chacon and everybody in place. 4 rolled around, then 4:30, and before long it was getting dark outside and I still had no bike. I had given directions to my place, so there shouldn't have been any problem. I put in a call to Evo. "Yo, brother, I've been waiting for your guys to show up now for going on 2 hours, and ain't nobody showed up yet. What's going on?" "The guys are still here in the shop," he said. "They're too stupid. They got lost trying to find your place." "Yo, brother, just how stupid are they? Straight out the 10 to the 57, then take the second exit after they pass the 91. Evil said that he threatened to beat their asses if they didn't get the bike over to me pretty damn quick. I told Evil that I would meet them right at the off-ramp from the 57. I'd be in my Mustang. Everything was set again. I was sitting at the Diamond Bar exit off the 57 freeway when a blue van pulled up, followed by a guy riding a new Harley-Davidson Softail Springer. I had $2,500 in my pocket to pay for that beautiful $20,000 bike. We rolled into the parking lot of my complex, and I met the main player, a heavy-set Hispanic male in his mid-20s. Once upstairs in my UC pad, I talked with him about supplying more motorcycles. "I'd need him to transport them to Las Vegas," I told him, "to my stolen motorcycle partner there." "No problem," he said. I told him I needed to cut Evil out of the business because I needed to make as much as I could, and another middleman might just kill my cut. He said he was ready to do business directly with me. I pulled the $2,500 from my pocket and handed it over. He counted the money, then shook my hand. It was now completely dark outside. On the way outside to the van, I made a couple of incriminating statements in front of everyone in the van about what had just happened. I asked about the cops, and two guys spoke up from inside saying not to worry. They were savvy enough to drive home using a different route, just in case the cops had been tailing them. Now I had the evidence, taped evidence no less, that everyone in the van was acting in concert with the criminal act that had just gone down. I said adios to my newfound partners and waved as they pulled out into the darkness. Chacon was waiting nearby with a team of feds and L.A. County backup. They surveilled the van until it had driven more than 10 miles from my place, far enough that a stop by a black and white wouldn't look too suspicious. They had the cops in the black and white do a standard field interrogation and identified all the participants in the van. While they were making the IDs, I was back at my place locking up my newly acquired Softail Springer, then hitting the computer to type up the details of the transaction in an ROI. With IDs in hand, Chacon returned to the scene of the crime. He took down the numbers of the motorcycle and confirmed that it had been recently stolen from an individual south of L.A. The first part of our plan to show the courts just what was going on in the world of stolen motorcycles had been accomplished. Next, we went into the special construction aspect of the investigation. Special construction is the official state of California Department of Motor Vehicles registration designation for a customized motorcycle, as opposed to factory-made bikes by established manufacturers such as Harley-Davidson or Indian. My plan was that the SFV guys would help me tear the bike down and get rid of the frame and cases. Buddy from South Pacific Motorcycle would order me a replacement frame and cases. The only thing I didn't account for was how unreliable the Mongols could be. I rented a storage unit in Laverne, just north of Pomona, and about halfway between my real home in Upland and my UC pad in Diamond Bar. We were going to break the bike down there, and I would get rid of the incriminating pieces. ATF would wire the storage unit so that we could get the operation on sound and video. But during the process of wiring the unit, the manager of the storage facility noticed the mysterious-looking ATF van and came down to investigate. The whole operation was compromised in a casual one-minute visit. We couldn't risk staying and attempting a UC operation. We would have to find another place. Chacon and I decided that we'd take the bike back to my UC pad and do the operation right there. The only problem was, my apartment was on the second floor. I'd have to get my Mongol brothers to help me haul the Softail Springer up the stairs. With 3 or 4 big guys, it wouldn't be a problem. I went by South Pacific to hook up with Evil and a new SFV prospect named JR. Buddy was standing at the door and greeted me. I told him that I had just picked up my new Softail Springer and that I'd have it apart and back together in a week or so. Buddy said that he'd help me as much as he could. Evil asked how everything was going on the new bike. I'm going to have to take my bike to your place and tear it down, or get some help hauling it up to my apartment. Evil said that he would get some help for hauling the bike the next day. I talked with Buddy about ordering a new frame. I told him that I didn't have a lot of money and I wanted to get as far as I could with what little I did have. Since the bike had cost me $2,500, I would need some time to come up with the money for a frame and cases. "We'll buy a frame with a 6-inch stretch and a 36-degree rake on the front," Buddy suggested. "This'll kick out the Springer front and give it a sleeker look. The stretch will set the bike closer to the ground. Yo, Billy, it'll be one badass-looking machine." I told Buddy to order up the frame and that I would bring him the money by the end of the week. He knew I was good for it. The next morning, I was up early waiting for Evil to call. I hadn't slept much the previous night. My girlfriend wanted to do nothing but argue. It was 7 in the morning, and instead of a cup of coffee, I reached in the fridge and grabbed a beer. A true Mongol breakfast. I popped the top just when the phone rang. It was Evil. He said that JR, the new prospect, was on his way over to help get the bike in the apartment. JR was a big boy, but two guys wrestling a 600-pound bike up a set of stairs with a 90-degree turn was going to be a job. JR showed up at about 10. We stripped the gas tank, the fenders, and a few other parts off the bike to make it lighter. Then we rolled the bike to the edge of the stairs and began to push and pull it up. The front wheel was no problem, and the first couple of steps went easy. Then the back wheel hit, and everything changed. The bike wasn't built to match the staircase building code. The front wheel was one-third of the way up when the back wheel hit. Now, we couldn't stop to rest because either the front wheel or the back wheel would always be trying to run back downstairs. Tough going, but we were making progress until we hit the turn. I was huffing and sweating like a bull when I called for a timeout. JR was in no better shape. We held on to the bike as we caught our breath. We looked at each other without saying a word, panting away and wondering where the hell all the help from the SFV chapter was. I told JR that we were going to have to lift the bike up into a wheelie to round the corner. He looked at me with resignation. We gathered all our remaining strength and in one mighty effort pulled the bike up on the rear wheel and swung it around the corner. The front wheel came crashing down, and the bike ran back down the stairs until it smashed into the turn. We rested for a couple of minutes before finally wrestling the bike all the way to the top. To my amazement, no one had seen us. We pushed the bike through the doorway and into the living room, where I was planning to do the teardown operation. Exhausted, JR and I collapsed on the couch. I looked at the motorcycle that now adorned the living room floor. Now I truly had a biker pad. For the next few weeks, I spent my time maneuvering around the stolen motorcycle trade. Evil did most of the work rebuilding my bike on my living room floor and in his garage. Buddy helped by filing off VINs and furnishing parts. Buddy's wife used her name and business to cover the stolen bike conversion and to get the bike registered. Finally, after about 4 weeks, the Softail Springer was finished. It turned out to be just about everything I'd ever wanted in a motorcycle. It still couldn't outrun Evil's machine, but then no one's could. Most important, now we had the hard evidence to back up everything we'd surmised about the special construction bikes that were so common among the Mongols and the other OMGs. We no longer had vague theories to take to court about how these bikes were made. We had done it ourselves. We documented it all for later prosecution. Special construction in the Mongols' world translated to stolen motorcycle. Chapter 11. Living full-time as an outlaw gave me a perspective few law enforcement officers ever get to experience. I was often more at risk from my supposed brothers in blue than from my adopted brothers in the gang. Just as there were some decent qualities, loyalty, love, respect, among the outlaw bikers, there were some law enforcement officers who were little more than outlaws with badges. It first happened on a crystal clear afternoon in Los Angeles. I just paid a visit to Evil down at the South Pacific Motorcycle Shop in El Monte to work on a stolen motorcycle angle of the investigation. I was on my Harley, ripping up the highway, thinking of slipping away for a few hours to see my kids. We hadn't had any decent father-son time in months. I was gangstered out in Mongol attire, black jeans long-sleeved, logo-emblazoned black t-shirt, black bandana, Mongol scarf pulled up over my face, and my now well-worn Mongol patch. I eased my bike into Lower Azusa Road, cruising eastbound through the city of El Monte. I had gone only a quarter of a mile or so when I pulled up behind an El Monte black and white police car. It wasn't a big deal to me. It was broad daylight, and I was behind the cops, not in front of them. I eased up to the rear of the patrol car, trying not to bring any undue attention to myself. I was waiting for the light to change, daydreaming about my boys, when a screaming voice caught my attention. I looked to both sides, checked my rear view in an attempt to zero in on the disturbance. I didn't see anything to my left, right, or behind. I figured there must be some sort of ruckus going on in front of the police car. Then I realized that it was the officer in the black and white and that he was hollering at me. This police officer was acting like I'd just run over his firstborn male. His arm was out the window, waving and flailing at me to pass him. Go around me, you fucking piece of shit! Pull around me, you motherfucker! The light had turned green, and the cars in front of him proceeded through the intersection. The black and white sat stationary at the green light, and the cop kept screaming out the window. I rolled on the throttle, pulled into the lane to the left of the patrol car, and skirted by. The black and white dropped in behind me. My mirror was completely filled with the front grille of the police car, inches from my back fender. I motored on, trying not to make any sudden moves, and wondering what the hell this poor excuse for a cop was up to. This wasn't standard police procedure in anyone's handbook. The black and white swung over and pulled up alongside me on the right. I glanced over and saw a scarlet-faced cop glaring at me, intense hatred in his eyes. Get the fuck off my street, you motherfucker! You hear me? Get the fuck out of my town, you sorry piece of shit! I was too stunned to respond. And what could I possibly say to this guy that wouldn't get him more fired up? I just moved on toward the next intersection and stopped for the light. When I looked at the black and white again, my eyes locked on the barrel of the cop's service gun. You see this, you motherfucking piece of shit? Get the fuck out of my town, now! The light turned green. Getting the fuck out of town now sounded like an outstanding idea to me. I rolled the throttle. The cop car moved with equal haste. Gathering my wits, I remembered the digital ATF recorder on my belt and reached down to activate it just before having to stop at the next light. I found myself directly next to the black and white again. This time, I was looking down the barrel not only of the driver's gun, but of his partner's also. The cop's red face was turning purple. I looked up from the gun barrel and stared directly into his eyes this time as he screamed, I'll fucking shoot you off that bike, you motherfucker! I began to think that he might really do it. I yelled to the car next to me to look at what these cops were doing to me. The officers reacted by dropping their guns out of sight. The light turned green and I pulled away, making it obvious that I was getting the number on their cruiser. At the next red light, the black and white stopped short of the intersection. I began to walk my bike backward in order to get a better recording. My move was met by an immediate and armed response. You push that bike back here, and I'll shoot your ass right off of it, you motherfucker! It was a credible threat, and I stopped rolling. The light turned green, the cruiser turned right, and I opened up the throttle. With my blood pressure and heart rate going through the roof, I sped on with a mixture of incredulity, anger, and disbelief. I thought of going straight to the El Monte police building and giving it all up, admitting that I was a deep-cover federal agent, just to be able to confront these assholes defaming the reputation of decent cops. I knew that I couldn't do it, but I could fantasize. I rolled on and took some comfort in the fact that it hadn't been nighttime. Under the cover of darkness, in the absence of any witnesses, there was no telling what might have happened. As pissed as I was, we would have to wait to deal with the dirty cop issue until the undercover investigation was over. The SFV chapter was holding church at Domingo's place, followed by the standard night-out bar hopping in the San Fernando Valley. I had just gathered some information that a few Mongols had stabbed an individual during a confrontation at a bar in the Hollywood area. I didn't yet know which patches were involved, so I was carrying my NT recorder in my jacket pocket, hoping to capture a conversation about who was responsible for the attempted murder. I went into my secretary-treasurer mode, taking notes during church. Domingo, being a savvy criminal, kept the details vague, but he said that the Mongols needed to stay out of the Hollywood area for a while because of something bad that went down at one of the bars. The cops would be looking for any Mongol patches. The victim was too afraid to press charges, but still, the Hollywood area would be hot for a while. After church, we hit the place for the usual pool shooting and beer drinking. Everyone was used to me taking off around midnight. They all believed I had to be at my avionics job early in the morning. Rancid asked for a lift home, and like a true Mongol brother, I told him to pack up and we'd roll. I popped the trunk on the car and put my jacket with the digital recorder in the trunk along with my Mongol colors. Rancid took off his colors, folded them neatly, and threw them in the trunk. In OMG protocol, cars are called cages, and you never wear your colors while riding in a cage. One of the bullet holes my Mustang had acquired during its earlier undercover life had damaged the locking mechanism in the trunk. Now, the only way to pop the trunk was by using the electrical release inside the glove compartment. Just when we were pulling away from the place, Ranson said he wanted to stop at the liquor store. I went inside with him to pick up something to eat. Although Rancid had already downed a pint, he grabbed a fifth of JD and opened it in the store. He downed about a quarter of the bottle while standing in the checkout line. I was always astounded by Rancid's ability to drink. We made our way off the rock to the El Monte area, Rancid continuing to work on that bottle of JD. We were on Lower Azusa Road in El Monte when I passed a black and white sitting at an intersection with its headlights off. The memory of those two El Monte cops leveling their guns at me and threatening to shoot me was fresh in my mind. I damn sure didn't want to see what these cops might do if they saw the likes of a drunken Rancid who clearly hadn't had a bath or shower in over a month, a guy who at this moment made Charles Manson look like a choir boy. I mentioned to Rancid what I had just seen.
"Shit," he said, groaning. "I can't take a shakedown, Billy."
A few days earlier, Rancid had gotten into a pretty fierce fight with his wife. She'd called the cops, and Rancid had taken off and hadn't seen her since. He knew that the cops had seized a gun from his pad, and that they had been back to his place, and he thought they likely had a warrant out for his arrest.
"I know they got paper on me," he said.
I looked up in the mirror and saw headlights come on. The black and white pulled out and began tailing me. I wasn't speeding, and I hadn't done anything wrong. They're right on our tail.
Man, I can't go to jail right now.
We heard the whooping of the black and white as they lit us up.
"Shit," Rancid said. "Don't stop."
I shot him an incredulous glance. "Brother, there's no way we're going to outrun these guys." Rancid turned and looked out the back window. We were passing by a school that had a large chain-link fence surrounding it.
"Pull over, brother. I'm going to jump out and run."
I stopped the Mustang and looked over at Rancid, who was now clearly wasted. He couldn't even find the door handle. I didn't want to give these trigger-happy boys any excuses. I opened my door and got out, putting my hands over my head. It was two L.A. County deputy sheriffs who had jammed us. With a sudden shudder, I remembered that I still had my switchblade in my pocket. Now I was sure that I was going to jail. One deputy approached me, and the other went to the passenger side of the Mustang. Rancid was still oblivious, drunkenly trying to open the door. No need. The deputy opened it for him. "Just be cool," I kept telling myself. "Just cooperate. They have nothing on us. They'll shake us down and let us go." I saw the deputy reach in and remove the open bottle of JD from between Rancid's legs. "What's your name?" he asked. I almost crapped in my pants when I heard Rancid's response.
"Fuck you! Out of the car!"
As Rancid got out, he lost what was left of his balance, falling to one knee and holding on to the car. He pulled himself to his feet, but was too drunk to stand straight. The deputy asked Rancid for his identification.
"I don't have any fucking identification."
The deputy maintained his professionalism, not losing his cool in spite of the way Rancid was testing him. He took Rancid by the arm and helped him walk to the rear of the car. He told Rancid to sit on the curb. Rancid tried, but fell over into the grass. The second deputy asked me to step to the rear of the car, then off the street and onto the grass. "Have you been drinking, sir?" "I had a few beers earlier in the evening, but none in the last 2 or 3 hours." He proceeded to give me the field sobriety test. "Sir, stand on one leg. Put your arms out by your side, lean your head back, and close your eyes. With your arms extended, bring your right hand in and touch your nose with your index finger. Now, your left." I wasn't worried about the sobriety test. I wasn't legally drunk, and I was being as cooperative as Rancid was being belligerent. Behind me, I could see Rancid sitting on the curb, spewing profanities, demanding his attorney, even as he began to list 20 degrees to the left, nearly falling into the grass again. The deputy asked for his name. Rancid threw out a bogus one, Richard Clay. I listened intently because I knew they would be asking me to repeat my friend's name. The deputy asked Rancid to repeat his name. This time he answered with a different name, John Martinez. A backup black and white arrived at the scene with two more deputies. One of the deputies went immediately to the Mustang and began to look through it with his flashlight. When he opened the console, he found 2 9mm bullets. He came back and showed the bullets to the other deputies, who then asked both of us if we had any weapons on us. I kept thinking about the switchblade in my pocket.
Fuck you! Rancid yelled.
Rancid's outburst provided me with a perfect diversion. While the deputies were focused on him, I pulled the knife from my pocket and tossed it silently into the grass. Too late. One eagle-eyed deputy had seen exactly what I'd done. Our eyes met in a moment of silent recognition. I wished more than anything I could tell this officer who I really was. He didn't walk over to the switchblade immediately. He began to question me about guns. I swore that I didn't have any on me. He led me to the curb to sit next to Rancid, who was now listing another 10 degrees to port. I leaned over to Rancid and whispered in his ear,
"What the fuck is wrong with you? You need to cooperate or we're fucking going to jail."
"Yeah, fuck it. I'm going to jail anyway."
Two deputies were now going through the car, asking me how to get into the trunk. I almost visibly shook when I remembered that I had my government NT tape recorder in my jacket pocket. If they pulled that out in front of Rancid, I'd have some serious explaining to do. I told the deputy that the trunk had been damaged some time ago and was permanently shut. He wasn't stupid enough to go for that. Meanwhile, another deputy had opened the glove compartment and was trying to open the trunk with the electronic release button. The ignition switch had to be on for that release button to work, but soon enough, one of the deputies figured this out. He turned the ignition and then hit the trunk release. The trunk popped open, revealing 2 carefully folded sets of Mongol colors. The deputies didn't touch a thing in the trunk. They yanked us to our feet, then threw the handcuffs on. I was escorted to the black and white parked directly behind my car, and Rancid was taken to the second black and white behind that. Deputies now tore apart everything in my bullet-riddled undercover Mustang. One deputy pulled out my jacket and went through the pockets. In no time, out came the NT recorder. An NT is not some standard tape recorder that Joe Citizen can pick up at the nearest radio shack. It's a tiny, sophisticated, very expensive digital surveillance device that only a member of law enforcement would use. I was horrified as I watched him toss it roughly on the roof of the Mustang. I looked back to see if Rancid had observed what just happened, but I couldn't get a good look at his face. As we waited in our cuffs, the deputies continued to tear the car apart. One deputy even took a screwdriver and lifted up the floor panels by the seats. The Mustang had been hardwired by ATF technicians, and these unsuspecting deputies were about to expose an even more expensive and sophisticated recording setup. I'd been in the back of the black and white for about 30 minutes when I was approached by a sergeant for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He opened the front door and peered at me through the metal separator. "What's with all the recording equipment? You want to tell me what's going on?" It was time for me to try some fancy Chacon-style tap dancing. I told the sergeant that I worked for an avionics company and that we bought and sold high-priced equipment that was all serialized. Any mistakes on model numbers and serial numbers could cost the company tens of thousands of dollars. I told him whenever I bought anything, I put the whole transaction on digital tape. If he wanted, he could even listen to the tapes right now. The sergeant didn't call my bluff. He didn't say another word to me. He went back and talked with the other deputies. I'll never know if these cops bought my far-fetched alibi, or if they suspected I was an undercover cop and were smart enough to let it alone. They had us stopped for more than 2 hours when they decided to let us go. One deputy hauled me from the back seat, whirled me around, and unlocked the handcuffs. He told me that he was going to write me a ticket for a taillight being out, and that he was going to write my friend up for an open liquor container. I couldn't believe they were letting us walk. Not after all the obscene abuse Rancid had spewed at them. But these officers were the polar opposite of the two goons who'd leveled their service pistols at me. The deputy told me that he'd put my knife in the trunk of the car and warned me that carrying a switchblade was illegal. I nodded, then went immediately to my car, retrieved the NT tape recorder sitting on the roof, and quickly tucked it away in my pocket, turning to look at Rancid. Fortunately, he was still cuffed inside the other black and white and was now practically comatose. Two deputies walked back to the car and opened the back door to let Rancid fall out like a big sack of dirty laundry. I could hear one of them shouting, "Okay, buddy, get up! Hey, get up!" They laid him on the ground and then told me to get my buddy on his feet and out of there. I did my best to lift him, but Rancid weighed a good 220 pounds. There was no way I was going to get him up and into my car. I turned to the deputies. "Can you at least help me get him back to my car?" They said nothing, but two deputies walked over to Rancid and grabbed him by his arms, pulling him first up to his knees, then to his feet. I thought that Rancid would walk with them to the car, but when they took one step, he collapsed on his face again. The deputies held on, dragging him to the car. They tossed him in head first and told me again to get him the hell out of there. I wrestled and shoved Rancid until I got him completely in the car. I couldn't believe we were leaving the scene with only a couple of tickets. We made it to Rancid's place in just a couple of minutes, and I thought that I was going to have to leave him propped up against the apartment building wall. But much to my surprise, when I hollered for him to wake up, he started blinking at me. He didn't remember a thing about being stopped by the cops. He didn't even remember leaving the place. He just thanked me for the ride home and got out of the car. As I drove home, I put myself in these deputies' shoes and realized that they must have known what was going on. I figured that they didn't want to be responsible for blowing some undercover deal. Chapter 12. There was one thing I didn't realize when I accepted this undercover assignment: how much it was going to change me. I'd been all fired up to infiltrate the Mongols and do the grueling investigative work. I'd been mentally prepared for the danger, the violence, the guns and drugs, the challenges to my undercover identity. What I hadn't fully anticipated was the emotional turmoil. I really had to abandon all semblance of my personal life for the duration of the undercover role. The scrutiny was bad enough when I was a lowly prospect, but it got worse once I became a patched-in member and club officer. Before you can become a full patch, they make copies of your picture and distribute it to every other chapter in the club. Every patch studies your face closely and considers whether they have a problem with you or may have known you at some point. Every patch stares hard at you and weighs the possibility that you might be a cop trying to infiltrate the club. There are several hundred Mongols and known associates just in Southern California. So when you're out on the street, there's always a chance of running into them. You realize that even in a state the size of California, you're trapped in a kind of prison of your own making. You can no longer pick up your kids and go to a movie or an amusement park. You can't walk into a restaurant because you might run into some of the most violent criminals in the nation, psychopaths who are supposedly your closest friends. Now that I was living the life of Billy St. John of the Mongols, my visits with my sons became less and less frequent. Holidays, weekends, birthday parties, baseball games, soccer games, the weekly dad time. I had to give it all up. As the months of the investigation rolled on, my hair got longer, my beard got longer, my sleepless nights got longer. There was no such thing as downtime or being off duty. Because of my appearance, I couldn't go anywhere and be considered a member of mainstream America. In my mind, of course, I remained a federal agent, a decorated military veteran, a clean, caring, conscientious parent. But my offensive appearance announced something quite different to the world. Everywhere I went, shopping for groceries, getting gas, people looked at me with disgust or fear. My ex-wife Carrie and our kids were living in a modest suburban Southern California neighborhood. Our boys were attending a good public school. Carrie called me one day to see if I could take the boys to parents' night. "Of course, Carrie," I said. Regardless of everything else that I was pretending to be in my Mongol undercover investigation, I decided I was a parent first. I wanted to look nice for my kids. I still had a closet full of suits, dress shirts, and ties, though I hadn't worn them in several years. But as I looked at myself knotting my tie in the bedroom mirror, it was obvious that I looked more like a homeless person who'd had his first bath in months rather than a conservative, concerned dad. I knew I wouldn't fool anyone in that suit and tie. I took them off and put on my jeans and a white t-shirt. I told myself that appearances weren't everything. I would speak to my kids' teachers like an educated government agent. I would carry myself with dignity, and people would be as accepting of me as they were of the next parent. As I parked my car at the school and my sons got out, I watched all the other parents and kids recoiling from me, with a reaction just short of panic. Before I could even offer a friendly good evening, everyone turned away. I wanted to put my arms over my kids' shoulders and walk them into the school, but I was worried that it might not be in their best interest. It took me a moment to gather my composure and remind myself that I was not the scumbag outlaw biker I appeared to be. The kids and I made our way to my older son's classroom. There were only a couple of parents sitting with the teacher while the kids played together. My kids joined the others as I made my way toward the teacher. I moved right up and introduced myself. The other parents were civil, but obviously disturbed by my appearance. The other parents said their goodbyes to the teacher, gathered their children, and left without exchanging any pleasantries or making eye contact with me. There was no one else left in the classroom now. I turned to the teacher. "Listen," I said, "so that you don't get the wrong impression, I want to tell you who I am." She stared at me with some confusion. I reached into my jacket pocket and produced my ATF credentials. "I'm a special agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. I'm forbidden to tell you the details of my job, but I'm working an undercover assignment, and that's why I look the way I do. I know my appearance is alarming, but it shouldn't reflect badly on my kids. It's important to me that you know the truth." I don't think she had any idea how badly I needed to get that off my chest. It was more than just the stigma of being judged at parents' night. I was trying to regain some sense of my real self. I could see the immediate relief in her face, but she didn't fully relax. We talked about my older son. Then she thanked me for stopping by and ushered me to the door. She looked around for someone else to converse with, for some form of polite escape. She excused herself and hurried off to the room next door. It was one thing to give my all to an investigation. I had given up plenty of my own life, but my kids' lives were never part of the bargain. They shouldn't have had to sacrifice anything on my behalf. They knew who their father was and loved me in spite of how I looked. But the last thing I wanted was for them to be victims of any ugliness. I called to my boys and turned to walk away. They ran over to me and asked if I was going to talk with any of their other teachers. How could I ever explain my twisted emotions, the sense of shame, the need to protect them? It was easier to say that I wouldn't be able to talk to any more teachers that night, that I would call their teachers later. Standing in the busy schoolyard, I thought about taking them for ice cream, to a movie, or to their favorite amusement park. Something, anything, to make me feel like a normal dad. I wanted to drop to my knees, close my eyes and hug them, and let them know how dearly I love them. I didn't want to leave them. I didn't want to have to go back to work. There were days I was out with the Mongols when I missed those boys so much I wanted to cry. A lot of the Mongols had kids, but the way they treated them often enraged the father in me. Rocky and Vicky lived with their five kids in a rented house a couple of blocks off the main drag in Tujunga. It looked like a homeless shelter, with bodies sleeping everywhere. Kids on the floor, kids on the couch, kids in beds, kids crawling on top of kids. It wasn't unusual to find everyone still asleep at noon, or even 5 p.m. on a weekday. The house had a fence around the front yard to keep people out. The fence wasn't much of an obstacle, but the pit bull did keep even the bravest of intruders away. To be on the safe side, I made sure I always had a little treat for the pit. One day I stopped by it around 2 p.m. Rocky's two youngest kids, one of whom was called Rocky Jr., were playing outside. I knocked on the door and Vicky started yelling for Rocky, who was still in bed. I stepped inside the living room, which was kept as dark as possible. A couple of kids were still sleeping on the sofa and floor. The TV was on, but the volume was very low so as not to wake anyone. When the front door was shut again, with the curtains drawn, you couldn't tell that it was daylight outside. I looked around, found an unoccupied chair in a corner, and sat down to wait for Rocky. Vicky came back to the living room, pushing kids' legs out of the way. She had her bong in hand and was ready to get high. She sat on the sofa, staring at me. "This is some good shit, Billy. Want a hit?" "No, but thanks for asking, Vic. You go right ahead. With these five youngins, you need it."
"Uh-huh. And today is little Rocky's birthday, too."
"Oh, yeah? You guys gonna have a party?" She didn't even look up from the bubbling bong.
"Nah, maybe next week when I get some money," she said.
She took another long hit off the bong and lay back on the couch to enjoy her personal high. "Yo, Billy," Rocky said as he stumbled into the room, slapping my hand and hugging me tight. He said he needed me to give him a hand on his bike. Translation, Rocky needed me to buy him some parts for his bike. "Sure, Rock, go get dressed, and let's go get something to eat." Glancing around the room, I had to wonder if the five children would get anything to eat today. Vicky was half dozing on the sofa with the bong in her lap. It had been uncomfortable for me sitting there in the dark, and I half leaped for the door, squinting as I walked back out into the bright, sunlit California day. I reached into my jacket pocket for my shades. Rocky's two little ones were still playing and laughing in the front yard. It always unnerved me to see Rocky's kids playing near that massive pit bull. I knew that if the dog turned on one of them, it would surely kill the kid before anyone could do anything about it. I turned to Rocky. "Hey, today's little Rock's birthday, huh?" Rocky pushed past me with a rude grunt.
"Yep."
I made my way back to my bike, staring at him. What a piece of shit. Doesn't give a damn about his own son's birthday. Rocky prepped his bike and began to kick and kick. It usually took at least a dozen kicks before that bike would turn over. Today was no exception. I waited on the street for a few minutes till I heard his bike actually fire up. I knew better than to start my bike before Rocky was underway. I'd burn more gas waiting for him than on a long haul to the desert. He made his way up the sidewalk and through the fence. I fired up and we took off. After eating lunch and making a quick stop at the auto parts store for a set of six banger Chevrolet points that fit a Harley distributor, we were on our way back to Rocky's. I had gotten away with only buying lunch and a set of points. Since the money was coming out of my personal pocket, it was too complicated and slow a process to try to get these petty cash expenses approved by ATF. I felt good about only having to shell out $20. I parked on the street, and Rocky pulled his bike back down to just short of the front porch. As I got off my bike, I bent down to talk with little Rocky. "Hey, buddy, so today's your birthday, huh?" He looked up at me with his big brown eyes and said, "Yeah." "How old are you today?" He held up four fingers. Then he looked back down at the broken toy rifle he was carrying. I felt a lump building in my throat, and I could have cried right there. No way this little boy wasn't going to have at least one real birthday present. I turned and made my way back to my bike, then yelled at Rocky, "Be back in a few." I rode to the nearby Kmart. I picked up a bright red fire truck and some chocolates and other candy.
The more I thought about the situation, missing my own son's something fierce, being unable to spend any quality time with them, the angrier I got. I wanted to call social services and have someone come pick up these neglected kids. I wanted to punch Rocky's lights out. I wanted to punch his old lady's lights out. Instead, I'd have to bite my tongue, swallow my anger, and wait for their day to come. I worked to control my rage as I made my way back to Rocky's place. I parked my bike, hid the fire truck and candy behind my back, and strolled up to little Rocky. "Hey, little guy," I said. "Happy birthday." His little eyes lit up, and he let out a gasp at the sight of the fire truck. He reached out and took his present. He held the truck in his lap and reached over to give me a hug, and I heard his tiny voice whisper into my ear, "Thank you, Billy." This time a tear did roll down my cheek, but quickly disappeared into my beard and the back of my grease-stained hand.
End of Disc 5.